Kentucky's poet, Naomi Judd, taught us that there are many paths, but only one journey. Over a dozen years ago, Dr. Michael Porter offered us some of the earliest views towards creating a new system of value-based care that focused on the patient. He implored us to build a healthcare system organized around the patient's condition, not the specialty of the provider. He beseeched us to use measures that focused on outcome improvements and cost of care. He appealed to us to provide payment models based on achieving good, not bad, outcomes. In the years since Dr. Porter's pleas, where are we on the journey towards value-based care? What paths lie ahead? And what is the role of data in this transformation? Welcome to Steps to Value, HIMSS's People, Process, and Technology podcast. In this episode, thought leaders from the HIMSS community help us navigate the journey that lies ahead for us. HIMSS Clinical and Business Intelligence Committee member Raj Lakhanpal will act as guest host for this episode. Raj is founder and CEO of Spectrometics, a healthcare data analytics firm. During this episode, Raj interviews Greg Allen, Director of Program Development and Management at New York State Department of Health. Raj also interviews Dr. Thomas Feely, Senior Fellow at Harvard Business School and Professor Emeritus at University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. All that and more coming up.
HIMSS communities are a great way for HIMSS members to volunteer by supporting their favorite health IT topics. Community members network with other health IT experts and professionals, contribute to health IT policy, develop tools and resources for the health IT workforce, and more. If you're interested in helping us shape the HIMSS mission, check out our 11 communities at hims.org/communities. Not a HIMSS member yet? Visit hims.org/membership.
Hello, my name is Raj Lakhanpal, and it's my pleasure to present this podcast to you. I am a member of the HIMSS Clinical and Business Intelligence Committee and a guest host for this episode. I'm here today with Greg Allen, Director of Program Development and Management, New York State Department of Health. Greg's team was responsible for creating the New York State DSRIP program, which is the New York Delivery System Reform Incentive Program, to transition 6 million members to value-based care. Also joining us today is Dr. Thomas Feely, Senior Fellow at the Harvard Business School and Professor Emeritus at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. For 20 years, Tom was the Helen Schaefer Fly Distinguished Professor of Anesthesiology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Thank you very much both for joining us, and I am very excited about this podcast. So want to start with Greg first. Greg, you've been very successful with the New York State DSRIP program. Can you talk to us about it, especially how has data played a role in achieving the success? And also, where are you today with your goal of reducing preventable hospital use?
Certainly. So thanks, Raj, for the opportunity. I'm delighted to be doing this with Dr. Feely today. So just a little bit of background about DSRIP. So this is a Medicaid waiver that we received from the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. It's an $8 billion waiver over 5 years that, as you referenced, Raj, is specifically aimed at trying to reduce avoidable hospitalizations and do other kinds of health and behavioral health improvement activities over this five-year waiver window. All the dollars go out on some form of performance. The beginning dollars go out on pay for reporting type activities. And then progressively over the five-year period, those dollars go out on a pay-for-performance schedule against very specific performance measures that were negotiated with the federal government. We have 25 performing provider systems, all regionally placed all across New York State, a large nerve center of them in New York City, and then distributed throughout the rest of the state as well. These performing provider systems, or PPSs, get attributed lives into those networks, and they work hard on trying to do important work like reducing potentially preventable readmissions, potentially preventable ED visits, and other measures of care. And very specific to your question of sort of how are we doing, we have this 5-year goal of reducing avoidable hospitalizations by 25%. And as a beginning for that, the reason why we focused like that in our waiver was in a previous Commonwealth scorecard, we were dead last in the country on avoidable hospitalization and cost. So we had a long way to go, despite a lot of money being spent in New York. So at this point, we basically require a little over a 5% reduction rate was required from our baseline each year. And we've been achieving about, on average, a 5.8% reduction in potentially preventable readmissions each year. So we are on track to close that 25% gap. And we're performing very similarly relative to our potentially preventable visits in the ED. So we are on track. We do see differential performance across those PPSs. But when our value-based payment part of this kicks in, we think we're going to kind of try to supercharge that.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to switch to Dr. Feely. Tom, you were at MD Anderson, and now you're at Harvard Business School with Dr. Porter. How has your perspective on value-based care evolved, and where do you see the low-hanging fruit in making improvements?
Well, I think it's important to sort of say at the outset, number one, thank you for hosting this, and thank you for having this opportunity for us to speak with you. I think it's very important when people talk about value-based healthcare that they really understand the premise for what value-based healthcare actually is. And what we're talking about is value for patients. And that's a balance between the outcomes that patients feel are important and the costs to achieve them. And I would say that we're very early in this journey. Professor Porter, who is my colleague and I work with very closely at Harvard Business School, first wrote about this in the mid-2000, 2005, 2006 time period and described an agenda that was focused around organizing care in a totally different delivery system, one that focuses on the conditions that patients have rather than the specialties that individual providers come from. For example, organizing care around breast cancer or colon cancer rather than around surgeons or internists or medical oncologists when we discuss cancer care. He also focused on some measurement principles of measuring the outcomes that matter to patients, and those include patient-reported outcomes, and measuring the true costs of care delivery, which healthcare does not do very well. And then the third major area is to provide reimbursement based upon achieving value. And these value-based strategies of reimbursement involve paying for good outcomes and not paying for bad outcomes. And then the other pieces of the agenda for centers of excellence to form, to spread, and to have an overall information technology support system that supports value-based care and value-based reimbursement and not our current fee-for-service system. So, having said that, to actually answer your question, we're very early in the journey. Not everybody is organized around conditions that patients have. Some organizations are trying to do that. Outcome measurement is very, very early, and we are steeped in process measures, which do not really assess outcomes and certainly don't necessarily assess outcomes that patients would report or patients care about. And all of these value-based reimbursement strategies, of which there are bundled pricing and accountable care organizations, they're very early and very untested. And some places are testing them, and other places are waiting to see what happens. So my bottom line is we're in an important journey to transform healthcare and healthcare payment, but we're very early in that journey.
Tom, you mentioned patient-reported outcomes. Can you elaborate on that? Because that was a great area of your expertise or your research when you were at MD Anderson.
We ended up in an interesting situation. About 7 or 8 years ago, we began seeing our competitors amongst the national major cancer care provider organizations starting to publish on their websites and in published materials their 3- and 5-year survival outcomes. And we wondered whether we should start to do that, and we began to have some focus groups and asked patients what they thought were important outcomes in cancer care. And we were very surprised in our focus groups to find that patients didn't focus on survival necessarily, but were really concerned about things about quality of life. What were some of the complications? What were some of the experience of some of the providers? And many of the things that the patients were concerned about were things that we weren't collecting. For example, in head and neck cancer, we found that patients, and as well as the clinicians, were able to identify speaking and swallowing as really important factors during the recovery and the long-term recovery following treatment for head and neck cancer. We discovered with our homegrown electronic medical record that we weren't tracking that information in a way that was collectible or reportable or something that we could even describe to our patients. And that became true for in many of these focus groups where what patients were concerned about were not the types of information that we routinely collected and certainly aren't the types of measures, the process measures that CMS requires hospitals to report. And again, many of these measures are patient-reported outcomes. They're things that patients can and are very anxious to report and actually can improve care. There was a recent study that demonstrated that in cancer care, when patients reported patient-reported outcomes, they had better survival because things were treated and addressed earlier. So we think this is a very, very important area for further exploration and something to move beyond its use in drug trials, but something that needs to be incorporated into routine care, not just for cancer, but for other medical conditions.
Very nice. Thank you. Craig, coming to you, you mentioned that you have reduced readmissions over the years. How has that data played a role in that, or data and lack of data, or how has that played a role?
Sure. And let me just say one thing about what Dr. Feely just said, because what he was talking about there is redefining the value equation and to bring what matters to patients into that value equation and to be able to measure that and then pay on that. And those are progressive steps and they're tricky steps, but relative to the audience who's likely to be listening to this podcast, I think that is a reframe in terms of like what do we need to get out of an electronic medical record that's actually going to matter, that's going to drive value long term in the healthcare space. And we are behind a lot of other industries in terms of actually connecting our dollars to things that matter to our customers. And I think part of what Dr. Feely was really referencing there was the fact that we have focused on process components of care that may matter as much to practitioners as they do to patients. So I just wanted to kind of underline that point. It's a really important point in this. Relative to potentially preventable readmissions and visits, what we've done here is we've taken the claims data in our Medicaid data warehouse that comes in regularly from our health plans and directly from our providers. And we are calculating a set of data that we group and then report out on a rolling 12-month basis. So every month we refresh annual snapshots for these providers and show them how they're doing at hitting their DSHRP targets. And we monetize state-set targets if they hit gap-to-goal percentages. So if we set a statewide goal for everybody, that's around the 90th percent of overall performance, we then pay performance awards for closing where a given network is for its attributed members from their current point to 10% of the goal to get into that statewide goal in each annual period. You know, as I said on PPR, we've been closing that a little bit over 5 years for potentially preventable readmissions. We've been closing it a little bit over 5% for potentially preventable ED visits as well. And there's been laser-like focus in really trying to wrap a lot of different care models around patients that had been readmitting and also patients that had been showing up with preventable conditions in the ED, trying to get them to the primary care doc. And this is all sort of upside only, pay for performance, there's no downside risk. But also in this waiver is that by the end of this waiver period in 2020, we've promised the federal government that we're going to pay out 80% of the money going out from our managed care companies to our providers will go out under some form of value. So the other benefit to these networks to reducing avoidable events is they will eventually be in performance-based, value-based contracts that will return shared savings to them for driving value against measures like these avoidable hospitalizations.
Great. Dr. Feely, what is your perspective on readmissions and such thing?
Well, in the cancer world, I think there are some real difficulties in applying readmission rates to cancer care. First of all, patients with cancer are admitted for a variety of reasons, and some of these are planned. And so a lot of the thought that goes into, gee, a readmission within 30 days of discharge is a bad thing for a cancer patient, it is not really accurate. Number one, these don't address the different cancer conditions that patients have. A patient with leukemia, for example, may very well be sent home for 2 weeks and brought back into the hospital for very, very good reasons. That does not reflect some poor quality care. And for programs to penalize programs for those sorts of things without understanding what are the underlying medical conditions that patients are being discharged for and readmitted for, I think is a reflection of how poor the current CMS system of trying to address some of these problems really is. There's no question that there are unnecessary readmissions and poorly coordinated care results in higher readmissions rate. But I think this discussion about readmissions is just a reflection of the fact that we really don't have good measures of outcomes that really matter on a condition level. And until we have those, I'm not going to be a big supporter of them. Now, I understand that Greg is functioning in a system that requires that these things be measured and accounted for, but I'll just go on record as saying that these things certainly in the cancer world need to really be carefully evaluated cancer condition by cancer condition.
Great. And if I could respond to that, I agree with everything that Dr. Feely just said. I would just say this, that when we drill into our data around potential preventable ED visits and readmissions, and again, we're not implementing a readmission penalty. We're doing an upside for reduction of readmissions that are, in the name, potentially preventable. Not all of them are preventable. What we are seeing is, in the Medicaid space, high comorbidity for substance use disorder, mental illness, people that have high crossovers as homelessness, poorly organized care. So creating some incentives to actually wrap multidisciplinary, multimodal, more mobile care around these patients just does accrue to the benefit of those patients that are not like the ones that were just described, those that would have readmitted anyway just because of the natural disease progression with even the best care. That said, I'm not going to stand here and defend just reward structures that look at potentially preventable hospitalizations, but we lag the nation in terms of having the highest rates of those, and when we look behind it, there were a lot of failures. Why do we have failures? We have failures because we pay for failure. We reimburse the most money to the most acute forms of inpatient care. And instead of tilting more money towards preventative care that could have kept some of these folks out of the hospital completely, and it's one of the few systems where we don't do that. So getting back to that data conversation here, when we begin, and I do believe this is happening now and it's going to happen at an increasingly greater clip, to tilt more payments toward value, I think on the data exchange, we really are going to have to start getting actionable clinical data in front of care teams to help them to help understand all of the kinds of important things to patients that Tom was just mentioning, and also begin to drive services to those that are more likely to benefit patients from preventing bad things to happen by increasing access to good things. And that is going to be a data job.
So looking back, would you change the incentives? I understand that readmissions was a top priority, but if you were to move forward now, would you have changed the incentives?
No, I wouldn't have changed the incentives. I mean, we had a problem with avoidable hospitalizations, and some of those were straight up failures to wrap the right kinds of care around patients at the community level. And I'm talking about two sort of signature measures that we are using, but we have many, many measures in DSHRP, and we also have subsets of these measures that we create high performance rewards around. And a lot of those are on med adherence, speed to ambulatory appointment after inpatient discharge, lots around behavioral health service compliance. And those measures are all monetized separately. It's just we watch the avoidable hospitalization as sort of a large marker, if you will, of better small things happening. And again, as I said, mobilizing care teams around these more high-risk members that are readmitting when they don't have to, showing up in the ED when they don't have to, and or just ending up with a preventable hospital visit, the first visit as well. And we're measuring all of that, and we're giving that data back to these PPSs. Now, most of the PPSs are, especially the most sophisticated ones, are marrying that claims data with their own clinical data. They're integrating that data and spooling it out to these care teams, the primary care physicians, the care managers, and then these mobile crisis teams, and giving them actionable information both from claims and clinical data so that they can change some of these numerators in the measures that we have. And then, as Tom said, we got to progress them, but also begin to look at hotspots of high-need patients, et cetera.
So, Craig, you've spoken a lot on opioid abuse and use and abuse, and that's a very hot topic in the nation today. Can you discuss what has worked in New York State, what data sets have been employed, and your thoughts on that?
So there's a few things that have been happening, and I've got to say that the Center for Disease Control work in this space has been really helpful around prescribing guidelines, because I think this country and New York State is sort of a microcosm of this overall effort, have been really struck by how much of this opiate crisis has been over-prescription generated. And so we, as an insurer in New York State Medicaid, like many other payers, have taken steps around prescriber education, but also taken steps around just insight into outlier prescribing habits. We've done some reductions in appropriately tailoring short-acting and long-acting opioids. Again, we, just for Dr. Feely's benefit, we always do this for non-cancer pain before he gets worried about us over-regulating cancer prescriptions. And it's had a dramatic effect. Our scripts per population have been dropping markedly over the last couple of years. And as I think some of that is prescriber education in the space, but some of it is some of the policies that we've implemented. I would just say the other thing that's kind of central to this is treatment availability, both pharmacological and non-pharmacological treatment interventions. And what the PPSs have been working on very specifically is working these action lists of individuals with opiate diagnoses or other high-risk prevention indicators, and really trying to make treatment availability both for Suboxone, buprenorphine, methadone, and other forms of ambulatory and inpatient treatment more available to the population. So to hit this right on the data side, it's information about the supply side on the prescription side has been very useful, and providing outlier analysis to prescribers has been very important. But then also on the back end, understanding the high-risk profiles of patients and beginning to wrap care teams around these individuals to mobilize treatment instead of just treating failures. And then Narcan availability has been another big policy piece for us. And data around that efficacy needs to advance a little bit more, but there is significant efforts there.
Great. Now, a last question for both of you. What's the future of value-based care? Do you think it'll accelerate under the new administration or under the Trump administration, or will it be placed on hold? Will it modify in different ways? What are your thoughts? Start with Dr. Feely.
I'm happy to begin. First of all, I don't think we should focus on any one particular administration in Washington. Healthcare delivery is not something that is the sole purview of the federal government, nor should it be. We are not in that sort of a situation. There are very, very forward-thinking states and other payers that are going to drive this agenda forward. Value-based healthcare is important to provider organizations. It's important to payers. It's important to patients. It's important to employers. And it's important to suppliers. It's very important that all of those entities focus around value for patients, and that is getting the best outcomes for the most reasonable cost. Our healthcare costs are still rising. The rate of rise has slowed somewhat, but we still have a crisis. We still pay more for our healthcare per human being in the United States than any other country in the world. And our overall outcomes in terms of infant mortality, survival, in terms of longevity, are worse than many countries that spend less than half of what we spend. So we've really got to get a grip on this. The fee-for-service system is in part the problem, and we need to look at new ways of reimbursing high-value healthcare. And these are not going to be overnight changes. These are going to be slow changes, but we're looking towards innovative states like the state of New York, who are testing alternative payment methods. And as we get more experience with paying for value, we're going to see that our outcomes will improve, our costs will be controlled. And once we engage patients in an understanding that they need to seek value in their healthcare, we're going to be able to begin to transform the healthcare delivery system, control costs, and improve our outcomes and be much more like the rest of the world rather than the way we are now with not great outcomes and incredibly high costs.
And Grace?
That was well said. I'll just say this. In New York, we've taken this very seriously. We've had hundreds of millions of dollars over this five-year period at risk if we don't get to 80% value-based payment, and 35% of that has to be with side and downside risk. So we are all in on this, and this is all happening under a federally approved value-based payment roadmap. And right now, we're at about 40% value-based payment, so we have another 40% to add to this by the end of 2020. So we're on this rocket ship ride to get this done. And it all pivots around data because we've got our health plans all teed up to get into contracts with these providers. They set a target budget. That target budget gets modified based on the provider's starting position with quality and efficiency. So both quality and efficiency matter for how much incentive is going to be earned by that network at the end of the period. And these networks look at these target budgets and say, well, what is the actionable component? Where can I drive more quality and more efficiency? And all of that really requires sort of real-time, drillable, actionable data that breaks, if you will, our lower quality quadrants down to say, here are the practices that have the highest risk patients. Here are the practices that, under the measures that we can measure now, seem to have the most quality gaps to close and, on a risk-adjusted basis, have the highest cost per member per month for a given risk cohort. And then to begin slowly, carefully, and prudently so that we don't lose access here, to get people focused on changing care around value for patients, not value just for the provider enterprise. And this can dramatically change things. When hospitals become prepaid, their admissions to the inpatient med-surg unit from ED can drop in half within 6 months when they have prepayment incentives, and they can reinvest dollars, say, from admission from ED to med-surg into home care, where they can wrap more multidisciplinary home care around patients because now they have the resources to more flexibly care for patients in a less structured environment. So very significant changes can happen quickly with the right kinds of incentives. We definitely need to progress the quality measures that we have, but this pivot from volume to value is essential if we're going to close some of those gaps that Tom was just talking about.
And if I can add, I think we could really use the help of the HIMSS community as we start to think about how to collect these measures, how to aggregate them, and how to get them into the hands of people who need them both for internal improvement as well as for public reporting and for payment. Right now, most of our electronic medical records are very, very poor at collecting both patient-reported outcomes and clinical outcomes. And unless one makes a concerted effort during the build of any one of these commercial EHRs, one has a very, very difficult time getting any data out of them other than demographics and things that would be important for the meaningful use program and things that are important for fee-for-service reimbursement. Those are old systems that need to be redesigned. We need to be able to collect outcomes that matter to patients from our electronic medical records without asking our doctors and our nurses to do more work than they're already doing in entering things into these electronic systems and be able to aggregate that data, assess risk, and then be able to report that both publicly so that patients can make choices as well as to provider organizations so that they can improve. And finally, to be able to reimburse our people providing that care based upon the outcomes that matter to patients. And we really need the help of our IT community to transform these existing electronic health records that are predominantly reimbursement tools for fee-for-service into things that will really support value-based healthcare.
The other call here is that all the literature is pointing to the fact that social care may matter as much, if not more, than medical care, particularly for taking care of certain conditions. And so the data job there is data connectivity. And some of these performing provider systems are, that we have here are really trying hard to connect data coming through EMR with education data, other kinds of social service data, housing data, criminal justice data. And that job, I think, is going to eventually be the job of an IT community to do master data management properly and to be able to connect this, because when networks of healthcare get rewarded on closing meaningful quality gaps, particularly in the Medicaid space that I work in with real high risk, high need patients, that's going to require data connectivity across other silos of data, which is a hard job, but a necessary job. And so that's the other challenge, is to connect data and then make it digestible for these care teams and integrate it in a way that it's a value add instead of just getting a blizzard of information in separate reports. And I think that's going to be another critical sort of rallying cry that's going to be important to this work.
This was very, very nice. I just enjoyed listening to both of you, and I hope the HIMSS community also greatly enjoys listening to this podcast. Thank you very much for your time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Carrie Amato, Director of Professional Development at HIMSS, where I'm responsible for developing and executing our educational offerings, and you're listening to Steps to Value.
So where do you think we are on the journey to value-based care? Send us your thoughts as a voice memo or an email, and we will play them on the air at the end of our next episode. You can send your comments to value@hims.org. We'd like to thank our guests, Raj Lakhanpal, Greg Allen, and Dr. Thomas Feely, for the wonderful insights they've shared on how the transformation to value-based care is currently shaping the paths ahead. For more information on all discussed in today's episode, please visit this episode's landing page in the HIMSS Value Suite. Steps to Value is a copyrighted production of HIMSS North America. The series is co-produced by Rod Pawlowski. Kelly Lippitt is story editor and guest relations manager. I'm Adam Baser. Join us next time on Steps to Value.